For many Americans, recycling has become a part of our daily lives. We dutifully sort metals, plastics, and paper into color-coded bins. But do you ever think about what happens next? For more than two decades, the U.S. has exported as much as 40% of its recyclables to China every year. But in January 2018, China said it was limiting the type of plastic it would accept. Now, a little over a year later, we're starting to see the consequences of that decision. Recycling has gotten way more expensive, so experts are concerned that more recycling could be getting burned or tossed into a landfill along with the rest of our country's waste. Take Philadelphia. In the summer of 2018, unable to adjust to the sharp spike in recycling costs, the city cut a new temporary deal. Half of its recyclables would go to an existing recycling facility. The other half are getting hauled off to an incinerator located in the town of Chester City, Pennsylvania.
More trash that they burn means more pollution for Chester and this entire region.
Chester City is a town of roughly 34,000. 70% of those residents are Black. And Zulene Mayfield, who you just heard, has lived there for decades. Potential toxins from recyclables are just the latest point of contention between community activists and the local waste management facility.
They're going to always dispute that they're not doing anything wrong. You pollute every stinking day with NOxes, PMs, sulfur dioxide, every minute that stuff comes out of that stack. So don't tell us that you're not hurting us.
Today, Zulene is an organizer with Chester residents concerned for quality living.
I have family that lives in that city. I have nieces and nephews and cousins and friends, and my family is there. And nobody is doing the right thing by the residents.
We reached out to Covanta, the company that runs the Chester City incinerator, and they dispute that their facility is to blame. They also deny that burning recyclables has affected emissions from the Chester City facility. In response to a recent report in The Guardian, the company stated, quote, Covanta has been and continues to be committed to being a good neighbor to Chester.
We don't care, don't give a damn how any other people look at us as a community. Yes, it's a depressed area, but damn it, we're not stupid. And if they say it's such a good industry, well, then listen, we would like to share the wealth, and any other community that wants one of them, they can have the one we have.
Chester City is just one community dealing with the ripple effects of the change in Chinese policy. But their story is part of a much bigger conversation about how the United States will be forced to deal with its waste in the future. I'm Tanzina Vega, and that's where we start on The Takeaway. Here to talk about what that future will look like is Dr. Marion Chertow, professor at the Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies. Marion, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you, Tanzina.
So let's start with some background, because I was curious when I heard this story. Why was so much of our recycling system set up for things to be exported to China?
It turns out that China was a willing market, and we were very happy to be able to prepare our recyclable goods to a sort of a minimum level. And it was a happy marriage for many, many years. China needed materials. We had materials to give. China was willing to sort our waste a lot with lower labor costs and so forth. And all of this was slowly changing as China became more wealthier. Its own people created more waste. The drive for lower quality materials went down in the face of wanting higher quality materials as China developed. And for the U.S., we used to sort our bottles and cans and paper in a way that was better than we do now. We've allowed a lot of contamination to creep in by mixing a lot of materials. And then we became dependent on that. And we said, well, gee, China will take it, so we don't have to spend more time and money on it. As you can imagine, a lot of Chinese goods come here in big container ships, I should say. So they're going back to China empty. Here we can put something in them, our own waste. So it kind of worked out well for both countries.
When you say China needed materials, what do you mean by that?
Well, think how much China has grown in the last 30 years. They've built huge amounts of building infrastructures. Look at the cities that all have multiple millions of people. this is what I mean by growth, and you really do need materials. As I look at some of the early Chinese laws from the 1980s, I see that they were really designed to encourage more recycling in China because China didn't have a lot of the production and construction materials that it needed. And by encouraging recycling, they were able to bring in a lot of material. And I know it wasn't for environmental reasons because these laws were all about taxes. You know, you could pay less taxes if you would recycle more goods and concrete and steel and so forth.
I was expecting there would be an economic angle to this, Professor. Tell me a little bit about our relationship, I guess, there with China. Why were we here in the United States, and specifically in the story that we're looking at, Philadelphia, so unprepared for that change?
To me, it's a little bit surprising. I spent many years in the waste and recycling business. China had been signaling us since 2013 that they were going to be pickier about not wanting much contamination in the loads of waste and recycling. And we kind of didn't take the cue. You know, we were happy with what we had and didn't want to have to revise the infrastructure too much. But remember that a lot of our waste doesn't go to China. You know, a lot of the residential waste goes to China, but, you know, I would say 60 or 70% is commercial and industrial trading that kind of happens on private markets of its own.
Now, I'm just thinking, whose responsibility? It just feels very expensive to say, take waste from a town in the United States or a city in the United States and put it on a boat and ship it across the world for it to then be recycled. Why was sort of China the world's recycler in many ways, or were they?
Oh, yes. China's really been the world's recycler. There was a very interesting journal article, academic article, about how China's taken in almost half of the world's plastic since 1992. So imagine that them taking so much plastic waste, but it's also a difficult waste to sort and reuse if the quality isn't very good. So you're right. How is it that that was economic? And the truth is it was economic in the 80s. It was economic in the 90s, and it started to get less economic as China's own needs changed.
Let's talk a little bit about what's happening here in the United States. We're looking at a city in Philadelphia, a town in Philadelphia that says that they're struggling with this issue. China's no longer taking their recyclables. They say that they're feeling the impact locally because their trash and their goods are now being burned and thrown into landfills. Is that something that is going to happen more and more, or is this a case study?
Two things. First of all, you're right to feel the pain for the cities, because I really think that's the party that's being hit the hardest. You know, a private vendor or a private seller of four recyclables can say, oh, well, gosh, this one doesn't have a very good market. I won't buy so much of that. I'll buy the other ones, and they'll be able to keep their business going. But a city like Philadelphia has to keep that waste flowing every day, and it has to get picked up or it becomes a public health problem. So in the middle of the year, if the waste company comes to them and says, oh, my gosh, we're so sorry, but with this Chinese waste ban and with a drop in commodity prices, because nobody wants them anymore, we're going to have to raise your price per ton of what you pay to have waste taken away.
And these are private recycling, Professor, or are these municipal recycling costs?
The way the trash works with the cities is that they typically, a lot of cities collect it with their own staff. But at the end of the day, these are commodities and they have to sell them into a market. And those are handled by private sector entities. So I'm saying the private sector entities, I'm not blaming them. I'm just saying they're doing the wise business thing of saying, well, if the market's not good over here, we'll go work on the other part of our market. But cities have no choice. Cities have to make the waste go away. They have commitments to their citizens to do recycling. So they want to make the recycling actually be reused. So what can they do in the middle of the year? I got a call from a city in Connecticut, and they said, we used to earn $5 a ton for our waste, and now with all the changes, we're supposed to pay $55 a ton for our waste. So, you know, how do you suddenly change in the middle of the year?
And Marion, the equation you just did, I'm wondering if you could help me understand the math on that a little bit. You said, so what happened here is that you said these municipalities were earning money on recycling because they were selling it to someone, and now they're paying to have it recycled. Is that what's happening?
That's happening to a lot of communities. Either the stuff is going into warehouses, or a lot going to landfills, a little bit like in Philadelphia being burned. And this was not what we all signed up for. We wanted to have cheap, easy recycling. And now we're confronted with having to rebuild our system here in the U.S.
And we also are hearing from activists in Chester, Pennsylvania, that are saying that the residents of that town they're having health impacts as a result of this. Are you, as someone who studied this, what are your concerns about the environmental and or health impact that could happen when tons of recycling stops getting recycled in the way that we've understood it so far?
It's a great question, and I personally am very sympathetic to the cities that are stuck in the middle, because they signed up for one thing and then world circumstances changed, and it's very hard for the city to be resilient in that way. So I would say, from an environmental perspective, you really have to look at each of the options. You know, someone doesn't want a garbage burning plant in their backyard. Is it better to send it to a landfill in the ground that's making greenhouse gases? Is it better to send it to a paper recycling plant that hasn't updated its investment in many years and may also be polluting? This is a very, very tricky question. We know what we don't want, but the question is, what do we want and how do we get there?
And Marian, are there any alternatives that you've either heard of or seen, whether inside the United States or internationally, that may serve as a model for what needs to happen here?
I've seen a lot of exciting entrepreneurial activity in the States, where, you know, private companies, young people say, hey, I could use that waste stream. I don't have to throw away these clothes. I could reuse them for something else. I've seen a lot of things at the national level. I'm optimistic. We are seeing a lot of investment right now in the recycling world, because companies are realizing they're going to have to adjust to the circumstances that have hit hard and that we're already a little bit late to the game. This is a real chance for innovation. Recycling creates jobs. So there's a lot of opportunity possible here if we can, you know, get our act together, identify the problems, start making the investments. We're reading less newspaper and we're getting more Amazon boxes. So cardboard has really changed its position in the market. All of this, you know, you have to be nimble to pick up on these changes and be able to deal with them and be profitable in that way.
Dr. Marian Chertow is a professor at the Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies. Thank you, Professor.
Thank you.
We head now to Brazil.
O atual presidente hoje do Brasil prometeu várias coisas e na campanha de alimentos.
The current president of Brazil promised several things. Throughout his campaign, he complained that indigenous lands were too big and that he wouldn't demarcate even 1 centimeter of indigenous land. Now, indigenous lands in Brazil are very vulnerable for invaders to enter and feel at ease.
Biteche is a member of the Uruwaiwawau, an indigenous tribe living in Brazil's Odoanya state. Once home to a natural landscape almost the size of Kansas, over the past 3 decades, Odoanya has seen more than 30% of its trees cut down. It is now one of the most deforested areas of the Amazon. Advocates like Kleber Bursato, Secretary General of Brazil's Indigenous Missionary Council, are concerned that the crisis is only getting worse under Brazil's new president, Jair Bolsonaro.
We are very worried because indicators suggest that in Brazil, there is currently a new phase of illegal invasions and occupations of indigenous lands that is underway.
Sam Cowie is an independent journalist based in Sao Paulo, and he explains that this is an escalation of a long, troubled relationship between Brazil and its indigenous citizens.
It was at the beginning of the 20th century, the first government body was founded to protect indigenous people. This was called the Serviço Proteção do Índio, the Indigenous Protection Service. This was replaced by the National Indigenous Foundation in 1967 after there were lots of reports of abuses committed against indigenous people, that, you know, they were shot at on their lands, that smallpox and other diseases were purposefully introduced to these tribes, basically to clear the land to make way for large infrastructure projects. Now, this happened throughout Brazil's military dictatorship from 1964 to 1985, where it's estimated that something like 8,500 indigenous people were killed or died of diseases. All indigenous lands were supposed to be fully demarcated and protected as of 1995 under the post-dictatorship constitution, which says that indigenous people have the exclusive rights to their lands. But if we look at Brazil today, we still see many indigenous lands that are not fully protected. And what we've seen, especially since 2015, really, when Brazil really fell into economic and political crisis, we've seen the situation getting worse.
What about Brazil now has a new president and Jair Bolsonaro. What's his take and his relationship with the indigenous community?
Well, Mr. Bolsonaro is a former military man. He served during in the army during the military dictatorship. He was a captain. He was a paratrooper. Mr. Bolsonaro has always had a very, very antagonist stance against indigenous people, according to indigenous advocates. You know, it's very much like the military dictatorship's position, which is, you know, forced integration, that these people are just the same as us, we're all Brazilians. One of the things he tweeted after becoming president was that indigenous lands, there's less than a million indigenous people who live on 12% of Brazilian territories. He's long had, you know, a very anti-indigenous stance in Congress, saying that, you know, their lands are too big, they need to be reduced. Who needs protection in Brazil is farmers and producers. And now that he's the president of Brazil, advocacy groups and indigenous people themselves say they are feeling the heat from increased aggressions against them, which they believe is caused by a mixture of Mr. Bolsonaro's very inflammatory rhetoric combined with serious cuts to indigenous protection bodies and environmental agencies.
What is the goal of doing that for the military or for the Brazilian government? I mean, what ultimately are they trying to take back land? Are they trying to control a population? What exactly is the goal? Because there is an NGO that found that at least 14 groups, indigenous groups and territories, were currently under attack in this way.
Yeah, I mean, they're under attack by criminals, basically. These aren't agents of the state. Loggers and land grabbers, you know, in the Brazilian Amazon. What basically happens is that first you go in and you take the wood, and then once the wood's been removed, then you clear the rest of the area, and then you plant some grass, and then you raise cattle on it, and then you try to sell the area over and over again. It's a land grabbing scheme called grilaging. Advocacy groups say that these criminals are in fact feeling incentivized and encouraged by Bolsonaro's rhetoric that, you know, a pretty much anything goes policy is going now.
Sam, can we talk a little bit about the racial and economic element here? I mean, this is obviously, yeah. these are communities of color also.
Yeah, absolutely. They're indigenous Brazilians. Of course, you know, they are the most marginalized group in Brazil. Brazil is a country that has more than 60,000 homicides a year. About 70% to 75% of those victims are young black men between the ages of 15 and 30. Now, of course, indigenous people in Brazil make up something like a 0.5% of the population. So they are also very vulnerable in the fact that they don't really have much representation in Congress. The first congresswoman from an indigenous background was elected this year to the state of Roraima in the Amazon. Mr. Bolsonaro said that Roraima state in itself, which is home to lots of indigenous people, it's a very mining-rich state, and he believes that lots of mining wealth is hidden under these indigenous territories. And in fact, one of the things he campaigned on was to open up indigenous territories to mining interests and also agricultural interests.
Sam, what type of environmental impact would that have?
We know that the Amazon is already about 15 to 17% deforested. You know, very specialized leading climate experts, they say that, you know, if this deforestation rate reaches more than between 20 and 25%, then the Amazon could reach a point where of no return, basically. Indigenous lands in Brazil, especially in the Amazon, they concentrate some of the best preserved forests in the country. And that's a real buffer to climate change.
And is the United States in any way involved in this? We know that President Trump has supported Bolsonaro so far?
Perhaps not directly, but definitely, you could say, indirectly through Mr. Trump's support for Bolsonaro and for the lack of regulations often applied to Brazilian products, especially timber, that head to the United States and are consumed in the United States.
Sam Cowie is an independent journalist based in Sao Paulo. Sam, thanks for your reporting.
Thanks very much.
Last Friday, the U.S. Coast Guard reported that it detained Lieutenant Christopher Paul Hassan after discovering what amounted to a planned terrorist plot, including an intent to kill journalists and prominent Democratic members of Congress. Hassan amassed a stockpile of some 15 weapons and left an extensive online trail affirming his commitment to white nationalism and his desire to incite a race war. The thwarted attack fits in with a disturbing rise in domestic extremism, and it raises even more questions about whether past and current military members are more susceptible to this type of radicalization. Joining us now is Janet Reitman, contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine and Rolling Stone, and she's also working on an upcoming book on white supremacy. Janet, thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So when we look at this specific incident, what does this tell you about how the military deals or doesn't deal with domestic terrorism in its own ranks?
I mean, I think that it's worthwhile pointing out that, you know, my understanding is the Coast Guard did, in fact, look into this and was alerted to this early. You know, so that's encouraging. But it's important to point out that the military has a rule that allegedly is supposed to bar anyone who belongs to gangs, which would include white supremacist type gangs, skinhead gangs, from joining. So if you have a swastika tattoo, you're not supposed to be able to join the U.S. military. If you, you know, have a history of being a part of a skinhead gang, you're not supposed to be able to join the U.S. military. This guy Hassan, he actually had been a skinhead like 30 years ago, according to his own letters.
Well, but despite all that, in 2017, there was a Military Times study that found that 25%, so one quarter of service members, had been at least exposed to white nationalism while serving in the military.
Yeah.
Is there something about military culture that draws these types of extremists?
I mean, military culture is, I would say that, you know, first of all, this 25% number, which I have also used and take seriously, that's not to say that one quarter of the U.S. military happened to be a white nationalist. And I think that's often, you know, interpreted in that way, that statistic. I don't think that's the case. I mean, I don't have any evidence that that's the case. But what I do think is that the white supremacist movement for years and years and years has encouraged people to join the U.S. military to get training for the upcoming racial holy war, right? This is, you know, their training for what they anticipate will be their great conflict. So that is, you know, certainly something that's been true for, you know, really for decades.
And what you're describing, again, sounds similar to a lot of the radical Islamic groups that we talk about,
yeah,
but the narrative here often isn't the same, right? The way we describe these groups often in the United States isn't the same. But
no.
You're describing something that's almost the holy war image that comes into mind right now.
Yeah, I mean, I think that both, you know, Islamic extremist groups like ISIS and far right extremist groups or far right extremist individuals, they have many of the same fundamental drivers and recruit in many of the same ways and in many of the same venues and appeal to young people using many of the same methods and are treated absolutely diametrically differently. I mean, there is an absolute polar difference between the way these two groups of people are treated. If this had been a darker-skinned individual, if this had been an African-American or, you know, a Muslim-American member of the U.S. military who was planning an act of domestic terror and had those weapons and had all of those same points, all of those same data points were
and
true.
And a detailed list of
And a detailed list. That
targets.
Whole thing of it. If all those data points were the same, but this happened to be a guy from a Sunni Muslim background, forget it, man. This would, you know how many journalists would be on this case? I mean, I reported on the Boston bombing, and I can tell you the competition, you know, and that was obviously an act of terror.
So what happened? Where was the media?
I have no idea. I mean, I was, you know, same thing. Like, it was, you know, people that covered, you know, extremism and terrorism were freaking out about this. You know, so particularly the journalists in the national security community all understood this was like a major deal. And, you know, the story has died. This thing about Jussie Smollett, mm-hmm. like that, that's the story that was above the fold, right? And so it's baffling, not surprising, but it's still kind of just boggles the mind that...
And it's fallen off. I mean...
Yeah, it's fallen off. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not, you know, okay, what's going on with the case right now is there is a two-week period during which investigators basically have to get more evidence of his being a national security threat. And there's been this big push right now.
Wait, let me just pause mm-hmm. right there, because wait, if I have a weapons stockpile at home and I am trained in how to use those weapons... and I am, or, you know, whatever we want to call them, firearms, what have you, and I have a list of people who I want to kill with those firearms, at what point am I not a national security threat?
I mean, that, well, exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. But they, I mean, they have him on these weapons and drug charges, and I think they need to... I mean, I don't... the rationale was we will hold him for 2 weeks... and see what you can give us in 2 weeks.
Can we, let's talk more specifically even, because we talked about the media, we talked about the way we sort of look at this, but the we here, is there a connection between the rhetoric that we've heard for the past 2 years, and I'm not suggesting that racism and white supremacy and white nationalism suddenly, you know, came about in 2016. That's not the case. That's, our country has often been, you know, that's rooted in our country. But has the rhetoric, has the openness of white nationalism, this sort of resurgence of it so openly contributed to what we're seeing today?
I think so. I mean, I think it's a couple of things. I think, first of all, you know, the role of technology, which everybody points out, but, you know, Twitter and Gab and these platforms, it's not only that there are online platforms, it's that there are a lot of them, and they continue to just pop up when one goes away. But I do think that this, you know, the rhetoric that came out of the 2016 presidential campaign and the whole emergence of Donald Trump and the way that he has played to a certain base has absolutely contributed to this. And you see that, you know, for example, you see in this guy, one of his little points was that he was researching was, you know, civil war if Trump is impeached. I mean, there's, you know, there's a lot of linking this president to larger white nationalist agendas, even though, in fact, many white nationalists and neo-Nazis do not actually see Donald Trump as one of them. He is a tool for them. He did not create them. They think that they would judge him harshly because he has a Jewish son-in-law and his daughter converted to Judaism. And all of a sudden, you would see that you see these white nationalist types being like, "Wait a minute, he's saying what we've been saying for years, like, so great, let's let him keep saying it." I mean, seriously, he's empowered their rhetoric in a way that I don't think they would have ever imagined.
Janet Reitman is a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine and Rolling Stone. She's currently working on a book about white supremacy post 9/11. Janet, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. Roller girl, don't worry.
DJ play the movies. I remember the feeling, flying around, turns, daring to try a spin. When I was growing up, the roller rink was pretty much where it was at. But today...
who roller skates anymore?
It's not quite the pastime it used to be, but two filmmakers set out to eulogize roller rinks and found that roller skating is actually far from dead.
When you listen to music you like to skate with, it's a feeling. It's almost like on Dirty Dancing when Patrick Swayze was telling Jennifer Hewitt to explain what dancing was to him. It was that goom, 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 goom over a heart. What it is for us is that goom, 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 goom for us.
That's roller skater Felicia in the new documentary United Skates, produced by Deanna Winkler and Tina Brown. And when Tina asked the question, who roller skates anymore, she was surprised to find a long, rich tradition of skating in the Black community that survived against all odds.
Little did we know that there was this thriving underground culture, and we were lucky enough to meet two African-American skaters who basically told us to follow them overnight on a bus trip from New York to Richmond, Virginia. And we literally walked into a rink at midnight where there are thousands of skaters from the African-American community, and it was just this vibrant, celebratory, amazing space. But I'm Australian and Deanna's from Hawaii and we're not roller skaters, so, and we're not African American, so we definitely thought this wasn't our story to tell for a long while, and skaters kept pulling us back in and basically were saying, no, you have to make this film.
Deanna, you traveled across the United States for this. What were you able to glean from those different types of skating cultures and skating styles that you saw? Because I feel like for those of us from certain era who remember actually skating on roller skates, it's weird. Like, people don't really remember that anymore. So give us a sense of what you found.
Yeah, well, you know, as Tina was sharing, when we walked into that rink in Richmond, everyone that we met was from somewhere else. And they all kind of said, we'd love you to come to our city, our state, our rink, and see what we do and film what we do. When we were in Detroit, it comes out of Motown, for example, and the rink smells like burnt rubber because of the style that they're doing is burning the toe stops and the sides of their wheels. And if you go to Chicago, it's all based off of remixed James Brown music, and they're doing nutcrackers, which is when they jump in the air and slam down into the splits really hard, amongst other moves. And, you know, Atlanta's got its own style and sauce, and we realized that all these rinks are still segregated. We would realize that there would be much heavier policing, that there'd be metal detectors at the door that would come out that wouldn't be there on the other nights of the week. You know, and these were families taking their kids to roller skate.
The rinks are segregated. It's 2019. Mm-hmm. Where did that start?
Well, during the civil rights era and after desegregation was put in place, actually roller rinks and amusement parks and public pools were the three hardest public spaces to desegregate. And so what happened was a lot of the rink owners saw what was happening to the amusement parks and the public pools, that there was white flight happening, that those venues were shutting down. And so they basically, the roller rink managers, came up with different tactics that they used to discourage the African-American community to come every night of the week or every day of the week. And so instead of calling it a Black night only, they would give it code names like Sepia night, or eventually, you know, gospel night, until it landed on adult night. But also during that time of desegregation, they employed other tactics, like they wouldn't give the right size skates to the Black community. They would come and rent skates and they'd say, no, we don't have your size. Or they would hire thugs to trip them on the rink. And then when the Black skaters would, you know, basically stand up for themselves, the white rink owners would say, see, when Blacks are here, there's violence that happens. So from that, just two different segregated nights or days remained. And out of that, I guess, came this beautiful community and culture.
And that is so often the story of marginalized and oppressed mm-hmm. Americans of color in particular. How has this sort of stuck with the Black community and why? Deanna?
We interviewed someone who said to us, you give us a basketball and we create the slam dunk. You give us a piece of cardboard and we break dance on it. You give us skates and this is what we do. And really, you know, that is the magic that you feel with these skates. And I think this community was very quick to make clear that we hear the word segregation and we just immediately jump to bad. And the truth is, it's complicated. And so, you know, that's always the irony, that by separating cultures, there is also an authenticity and a freedom that is allowed to thrive.
But it also has influenced in many ways some big names that we've heard of, right? Queen Latifah, mm-hmm. Dr. Dre, you know, a lot of these folks, NWA, a lot of these folks got their start at the roller rink.
Yeah, I think, you know, during the 80s, as you're mentioning, a lot of larger venues didn't allow these artists to play because they didn't think that the music was real music, or they didn't like the community that the music was attracting. And so a lot of these artists would The only space that was large enough for them to perform in where they were welcome were Black Knights at the roller rink. And so many of them actually did roller rink tours where they would go from city to city, from rink to rink to perform to large crowds. And that's how a lot of them got their start.
I remember the culture distinctly. I remember the skating distinctly. But where we are today, it feels like there are fewer and fewer skating rinks available. Tina, you're nodding your head. Where's the state of skating today and of being able to preserve this culture?
Yeah, I mean, we show it in the film, but we look at rinks kind of in the heyday. It was around the 70s, but we focus from the 1980s. And there was over 5,000 rinks across the country. And till last year, there was just over 1,000. And it has to do with, you know, gentrification and the cost of these spaces. Like the land value is too high right now that to have it anywhere near the city center, it's too expensive. And these rinks are being pushed out and they can't find the spaces.
Is it also something just that kids just aren't doing anymore?
Most people don't roller skate anymore. They see it as, you know, as a throwback to another era. They have a birthday party once a year with, you know, wobbling around on rentals. And so even though it's still thriving and there are just as many kids and families going on these nights, the other nights are rather empty. And so, you know, we actually need more bodies and more people to be skating as a whole than just this one community.
Deanna Winkler and Tina Brown are directors of United Skates. It's available on HBO. Thanks to you both.
Thanks, Tina.
I have some great memories of roller skating when I was younger. Strap on some skates, go to the rink. If you haven't done it, give it a shot. And here's what you all have to say about skating yourselves.
This is Kira Person from Columbia, South Carolina. And the roller skating rink defined our childhood. It was the one place outside of school where we saw the other people that didn't live in our neighborhood. It was a place for our first kiss, first handhold, and for some of us, the first broken bone.
Hi, I'm Maureen. I'm calling from El Segundo, California. I remember Rollerama in Schenectady, New York. I took roller skating lessons there. I attended birthday parties there. I tried taking my over 6 feet tall dad out onto the rink there one time. He fell within seconds. We never tried that again. I remember the taste of the pizza and the Jolly Ranchers and the chewy sweet tarts from Rollerama's snack bar. I remember couple skate and reverse direction and it's limbo time and slow skate and all skate. I remember skating to Journey and Quiet Riot and Def Leppard, and I know I'm really dating myself. I can picture the entire layout of the place circa 1985, and I just Googled it, and Rollerama still exists.
Get your disco balls out and your strobe lights. Give us your memories of the rink on Twitter. We're at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for skating with us. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and we'll see you tomorrow.